it is fantastic to have Gabriel Morris as my latest nostalgia interviewee. And of course, it's a Thursday evening. Now, we've just come off KMTV Kent Tonight, where you interviewed me, as you often do. Actually, I haven't for a little while, to talk about the Kent Film Club. So we're going to have a slightly more elongated discussion now, rather than trying to cover everything in a sound-bited 3 minutes. And it's great to have you on, because we have a Cardiff connection, don't we?
We do have a Cardiff connection. Yeah, I did my Master's in Broadcast Journalism in Cardiff in 2021 to 2022. Then straight after that, here down to Chatham on KMTV. So, yeah, I was in Cardiff for 1 year only. 1 year only I was in Cardiff.
Where are you from originally?
I'm originally from Hertfordshire. The Hertfordshire-Bedfordshire border. I always say somewhere in between Luton and St Albans. Somewhere between that two in the lovely countryside around there. Lived there till I was about 19. Went to university in Liverpool. Studied geography, the science side of things. And then decided, well, journalism is what I want to go into. I'm not very good at writing, so I'll do broadcast journalism.
Do you know, the number of people who I've interviewed, including our channel director in that sense, who never expected to be a journalist, but looking back, it was the obvious route, but took a very circuitous route, you know, didn't know what a journalist was, but didn't imagine that it was a journey they were going to take, but ended up finding that to be like the perfect synthesis, I guess, of all their different interests. So in your case, geography. Now again, a subject that was, when I was at university in the 90s, that was a huge subject. I was in Lampeter, one of the big subjects. Within 10 years, it was pretty much gone. So there aren't that many geographers these days that I come across.
No, there aren't. That was one of the reasons why. I mean, there was a few things I could see myself going into down the geography path. The classic, being a geography teacher. I did a little bit on that, actually, at university, doing some practical teaching, which was fun. It was really rewarding, teaching some young students, particularly during the pandemic, geography. But I just felt something about that wasn't for me. But there's something else, GIS, which is like mapping data and stuff like that. That's interesting, but it's very technical. It requires coding, and my brain doesn't quite work that way. But I could go, and lots of my friends from university have gone down this, and this is probably what I would have gone down. It's like environmental assessments, flood risk. We know there's a lot of development. As a journalist, I know there's definitely a lot of development in Kent. All these developers need to do this environmental assessment to figure out what the area is like. So that I could have gone down that. But then I was like, no, actually, I quite enjoy hearing, you know, in the stories in geography, because I did a bit of human. A lot of the stuff I specialised in was the physical world, interacting with the human world, so what happens when a volcano happens and how it's different in different parts of the world. Say, you know, I mean, if you're in a high economic area or a low economic area, that kind of interest, I mean, it sparked the whole journalism part of my brain. Go, right, that's it, broadcast journalism, that's where I'm going to go. Always had an interest in broadcasting, which I'm sure we're going to touch on later in this podcast, Chris. Always watched TV news. I think I was probably the only child to watch BBC Breakfast. There are other breakfast news available, but I watched that before school in the morning. So, you know, when I've grown up with news, and I just remember, to before we started recording, you were talking about teletext and the microphones we're using. You say the screens look a bit like teletext. I'm old enough to remember teletext, just about. And I completely forgot about this until about 5 minutes ago. But I remember when I was a child, I remember used to read the teletext pretending I was a news presenter. And there we go, we're doing
now,
it. Okay. We were doing it this evening.
Now,
for real.
Now, when this goes out, and I can imagine the reaction, because obviously I'm a bit older than you, but for me, teletext was the only way of getting news, because we didn't have 24-hour news when I was at university in the 90s. And I did at one point have teletext, but I had an old black and white TV, so in that case it was radio, really. Or the hourly news bulletins on the BBC during the day, you'd have a two-minute news with Moira Stewart or Chris Lowe. I even remember the presenters from all those years ago. But I used to read the teletext, and there was a bit of a joke in a shared house I was in once, because a friend wanted to know if I would join them down the bar one evening, and they came up to see if I was ready, and they stopped at the stairs. I didn't know this, and they thought, we better not interrupt Chris, because this became a running joke. I better not interrupt Chris because he's reading the news. So, and of course, I'd be doing this. Now, I've always encouraged my students to read their essays out, and I try and do the same. So when you read something out, you then realise, oh, the grammar is appalling, or this is a very long sentence. Because if you're just looking at it over on the page, you sometimes don't realise that. So how interesting that you did that, because sometimes you need to hear the sound of your own voice, because if you're going to be a communicator, then often we need to be our own worst critics, or maybe our own best critics.
Yeah, no, exactly. You do have to. You'd have to read everything out. Everything we do here at KTV, when we read the links, if you come into the newsroom, our show goes out at 5:30. If you come into the newsroom around 4:45, you'll usually hear everyone who's presenting the show that day reading through all the links and reading it out, because it might be well put together by another reporter, but it's not exactly in your own dialogue, the way you want it to flow. Everyone reads things differently. So when you say, if Abby's presenting, she always rewrites my links completely, because me and her read in a completely different way. And just the same if she writes something, I'll go and rewrite it, because we just read things in a different way. So yeah, no, you will. I know if I go and record a voiceover for a report, I'm like, really, did I write that? It's awful. So I'm just sometimes sat in the voiceover booth for about 5 or 10 minutes rewriting my whole script.
But can you watch yourself back? Because I know can, yeah. Abby was saying that she chooses not to, but you do watch yourself back.
I can. I learned that. I didn't like to originally, but it's the only way I think you can improve. You have to watch yourself back. You have to criticise your work. And I recently put in for there's an awards in Kent for journalists, Kent Press and Broadcast Awards, and for a year, it's for the best works of journalism you've done that year. Self plug, I did get nominated.
Congratulations, you on social media, yeah. But in person.
Thank you very much.
With an audience, huge and very well deserved.
Well, I had to go through all some of the old reports I'd done going back for a year, and I was looking through some of them. I'm like, wow, they are awful. How did I let that go out on air? Like some of the ways I've said stuff, some of the ways I've cut some of the pictures. And it shows how much you improve just in a small space of time. So you do have to go and watch some of your stuff back, because I think it's the only way you can improve. But it is sometimes brutal, especially if someone else is watching it with you. Then it's really brutal.
Yeah, and also we can be our worst critics, because when I started doing the 3 minutes on Kent Tonight in August last year, when I watched myself back, I was horrified. Because even though my students have been watching me for years, and I'm used to listening back to myself often with the podcast, or even when I teach, because we record ourselves, what I was aware of is that I was gesticulating a lot. And maybe it was slight nervousness, and I think I've got that under control. I don't think it's a bad thing to have, but I think it's probably good to be to show expression. But it was just interesting to be of a certain age, and then to almost think, gosh, I didn't realise that this is how I project myself to other people. So it's a learning curve which I needed. But the important thing, of course, is that you keep coming back and back and back. And the more you do it, you become comfortable and confident in that persona.
You do, don't you? And those 3 minutes, we give you such a small amount of time as well, isn't it? I'm always very conscious that I've got a whole list of questions there. Like, we're never going to get through those in 3 minutes. And I'm also always conscious, every time we get to it, I'm like, well, Chris, what's coming up on your show tonight? And I hear it in my ear, because it's the last part of the show, because we tease it's your show. And they're going into my ear, 40 seconds. And tonight I was like, Chris, in 20 seconds, tell us what's going up on the show tonight. So you did a very good job to get everything in a very small amount of time, which is something I can't really do, because this is very rarely. I think the last time somebody asked me questions was when we did Kent Film Club.
Yes, we did. Just before Christmas.
Wasn't it? Yeah. Yes, because I was wearing a Christmas jumper. Yeah. You were wearing jumper. Yeah. So that's the last. So it's very rare if it's ever happened someone asks me the questions. It's good practice.
Yeah, no, it is. But also on a Thursday, I sit on both sides of the couch. Mm. Interesting, I called it a character. There is a bit of therapy in there. But there have been occasions when I've walked to the wrong part, because I sometimes forget, am I presenting or am I the guest? But actually, there's a fluid link, and I think it's the case with our podcast here now. You must find that as a journalist, that sometimes you're asking questions, but you're having a conversation at the same time, both with the guest, to an extent with yourself, because you're kind of answering your own questions. And that can be a lot easier for the guest then to be able to respond, because they kind of feel that there's a way in. Because if you simply say, what's the answer to the question, then they might freeze. But if you give various scenarios, or you say, well, this is how I'd address the question, then they can immediately think, yeah, there may be already three or four different ways into that, and they can choose the one that they're most comfortable with.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I mean. Going out and about, talking to people each day. That's what I do hate. I'll say this. This is what I do hate. It's listening back to the way I ask questions, because I hate the way I ask questions, and I'm glad most people at home don't hear the way I ask questions. I listen back to the tape, and I hate having to. Sometimes we have to send the raw, you know, the way we are partners, KMFM, Ken Online, and we send them the raw whole 10-minute interview we do sometimes. If I do it on telly, I will pre-write the questions fully and I'll think about it. And sometimes, you know, when I'll go off script a little bit. But when we're out on location asking questions, sometimes it's a little bit more on the fly. We do prepare it sometimes, but I listen to some of the questions and I'm like, did I really ask that question in that way? It makes no sense. And I'm like, how did that person answer that? But most of the time it's good. I'm not going
to
diss myself.
Yeah, but there is an answer to that as well, because the person on, unless they're like, sometimes you get politicians who want to be argumentative, and they'll start arguing with the question or the framing of the question.
Yeah.
And if you've only got 3 minutes, what I would do is almost, I'm not going to say ignore the question, but if I imagine I misunderstand the question, I'm not going to bring the interview to a halt and say, what do you mean, or can you repeat it? I'll just answer in the way that I think...
That's true, isn't it?
It makes the interviewer more at home, but also it's good for the viewing audience, because otherwise what you're doing is bringing an element of threat or discomfort into a situation that doesn't need it. And so if I have 3 minutes, I'm going to use that. I'm not going to overtalk. I might overtalk, but if I'm given that free rein. But effectively, it's like, well, I want to present myself in the best light. So you think, you know, and of course, sometimes I misunderstand or mishear a question, but I'll do the best I can and answer it. And watching it back, I sometimes think, gosh, you know, I give a very fulsome answer, even though actually the question itself may have gone over my head.
No, yeah. That does happen quite a lot. I do that all the time. If someone asks me a question, never fully understand it. But I don't know if I should give a trick and a train away. I think I'll give a trick and a train away, what I do sometimes do, is I will always, when I'm doing an interview, I'll always start, regardless of who it is, I'll start with at least one or two easy, very broad questions that I know they'll be able to comfortably answer, put some at ease, and I'll be able to, you know, answer it clearly. Very straightforward question. I don't know, I'd go... Say if you were the owner of a big supermarket, I'd say, tell us a little bit about your big supermarket. What do you sell? Then I'll know in the back of my mind roughly what sort of angle I'm wanting to take from this. Sometimes you'll get a surprise and it completely changes your whole report. And if this is a last minute interview at the end of the day, that could be an absolute nightmare when someone gives you a line that you don't want. But I'm going off on a tangent. What I'd usually do is I'll ask the same question two or three times during the interview, but I'll ask it in slightly different ways so they probably don't clock. The first time they answer it, they'll be answering it in a way that they're thinking about the question, and they'll give an answer somewhat coherently. But a second or third time, it'll be a really coherent answer and they'll know it. And I always say to them, feel free to repeat stuff as you go along, so they know they can freely repeat stuff, because we can only use 30 seconds of a 10-minute interview. Obviously, if you're doing this live, I'm not going to ask the same question three or four times, but... You know, doing something pre-recorded, it does sometimes help to get something out.
But you see that with politicians, but I won't mention any. But we've had previous leaders of the opposition, or quite senior politicians and prime ministers as well, who, when you see the full interview with the journalist, that all they want to do is get the sound bite across, and the journalist might be asking the question that is about something awkward, like maybe one of their MPs has done something embarrassing and they don't want to talk about it. And so they'll give the answer that they want to give, and the journalist will come back and say, you haven't really answered the question, and they'll put the question up again. And they'll answer in exactly the same way. And so it's an interesting thing, because the soundbite might go out on the news, but then you see a different side, because clearly what's interesting is not just the answer that the Prime Minister or leader of the opposition, whatever it might be, gave, but it's the fact that they didn't answer the question that they were given, and they were clearly going to give an answer of their own. And even sometimes when they're asked multiple questions, variations of the same thing, like the famous dialogue, or you know, between Michael Howard and Jeremy Paxman. And but it's almost as though, you know, that sort of goes on, but they just give the same answer they want to give, and it bears no relation to the question. But they probably just work out that that's probably the most expedient answer they could give, even if it's a little bit dishonest, because they're not actually answering the question, but they're not pretending to, you know, they're not saying, I'm not going to ask you a question. They act as if they're answering the question, but they just give their own completely.
Sometimes they don't answer the question at all. You know, because as you said, they go on a completely different tangent. I interviewed the leader of the opposition, as you're saying, at the start of the election campaign, Keir Starmer. He was in... He launched his campaign in Gillingham, Priesthill Stadium, home of Gilles FC. I asked him a question, local democracy reporter, so I don't just cover Kent, I cover the whole of the South East. All the other reporters were asking Kent-based questions. I was the last person up. Wasn't really meant to ask a question. My colleague Oliver was asking a question for KTV, but I thought, oh, I'll just pop in, ask a question for the LDRS service, and I thought I'd be a little bit cheeky. Daddy Brighton, it's the only Green MP currently, at the time of recording, I'm going to say that, at the time of recording, the only Green MP, well, there are no MPs at the time of recording, Green MP, you know what I mean, Chris.
The record, we're recording on the 20th of June.
Keir Starmer might not even be the leader of the opposition on the 20th of June, who knows, it'd be interesting to see what happens when people are listening to this. Anyway, going back to my point, I asked Keir Starmer, do you think, you know, you're targeting lots of Conservative seats trying to flip them to Labour. Brighton has the only Green seat in the country. Do you think Labour could flip that Green seat to Labour? I thought I'd ask him that question, because no one was going to ask that question. Probably no one will ask that question in a campaign. Didn't answer at all. So there we go. But I was hoping that, I thought that'd be a really good news line if he was going to directly mention that Brighton, I think it's Brighton Pavilion, if he was going to directly mention that seat that he did, he just gave his numeral line that he grew up in a pebble dash house in Surrey or something like that. So there we go.
Oh yeah, on the border between Kent
and Surrey. Yeah. So it was good. Yeah. You know, it was so usable for the LDRS. It was actually a really good line for all the local democracy reporting service partners, because it was a really broad line that if you lived in Kent, Medway, Surrey, Sussex, you could all use it. I even tagged Essex and other places in it, because he used the South East. I was like, there we go. Any topic about how he could use that line, because it was nice and broad, and he spoke for 1 minute, which was absolutely brilliant. Just didn't answer my question.
Yeah. and I've got to ask about radio as well.
Yes,
because,
of course.
Because at the time that we're talking, I have just, with the last 2 weeks or so, started doing a radio show. And I know you were telling me earlier, before we started recording, hospital radio, was that in Cardiff?
That was in Liverpool. Yeah, Radio Broad Green. That was for Broad Green Hospital in Liverpool. I did that for about a year and a half. Some of that during the pandemic. I sort of started just before the pandemic. But I did a few shows remotely during the pandemic. So during the pandemic, then afterwards did another series of it. My show was called Feel Good Friday, 2 hours, feel good music, and a few links in between. I loved doing that. That was one of my favourite things I've done. It was on a Friday evening. I don't know, as a student, why I thought it was a good idea to go and do a radio show at 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. on a Friday evening. So that was clearly my social life in second and third year at university.
Maybe you were kickstarting the whole of Liverpool.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. No, students always go out on a Tuesday and Wednesday. That's why I was able to go and do it on a Friday night. But no, it was great fun.
Did you get to play any of the music? Did you have carte blanche?
I had complete free range of music. I was allowed to play anything. The demographic of a hospital radio is mostly older. So I had that at the back of my mind, and I knew the channel producers, you know, they'd want that to be there. But I did also want to bring in some newer music, some new things which I knew would work for a wider audience. So I put that into it. I think I did, because Friday is when new music gets released, and I think I did like the new music, like my favourite release of the week or something. Like, I can't remember the name of the segment, but I did that. I did some fun challenges during the show. Like, I'll do like cryptic puzzles and stuff like that. But yeah, it was good fun. I did student radio as well. That's a completely different kettle of fish. I did lots of student radio. I did two shows. I mean, during the pandemic, there was nothing really to do. So I set up a whole radio studio from my university bedroom. I don't know how I did it, but I managed to set up a whole, with multiple microphones, had a condenser, whatever you call it, a filter where it filters all the sound out, like multiple three microphones, I think it was, multiple computers which were playing out stuff. It was mental. I did that. That was kind of how I just spent my pandemic. I just built this whole studio in my bedroom, but I had to take it all down at the end of the year, and I've never got around to rebuild it. So I've just got loads of radio equipment under my bed. And honestly, I didn't have a clue what I was doing to set it up, but I've probably spent two or three weekends just pushing wires in and out of things till it sounded right, and then it started to work. So that was good fun. I did two shows.
And did you do them live, or were these?
These shows were home. I did it live. The way it worked for student radio is you could basically connect from anywhere in the UK. It's complete fluke. They changed the system around. It used to be that you could only do it from the studio, but it changed to they now use a cloud-based server. So basically, you could remote in basically any studio. You just have to connect it to the internet, and it would work. I can name the I think it's radio.co. I'm sure there are other different providers out there, but that's what we used to use. And so I could just connect the spare room in my student house to turn into a radio studio. I did 4 hours of live radio during the pandemic. I did a show called Indie Amplified Indie Music. I did that with my friend Lucy from university. We just talked about indie music, basically just talking nonsense. And Throwback Thursday with my friend Adam, that was obviously on the Thursday night, and that was like throwback music from late 90s, noughties and tens, and that was a really good fun. Me and him, basically, we just played new music. It was a bit like, you know, if you ever listen to Chris Miles' show on Radio X, they just never play any music. That was essentially that. We never played any music. We just talked. Yeah. But we were like, oh yeah, we should probably play a song.
there were two of you then. So that,
yeah, always yeah. Two of us. I mean, my first year, we had about six of us in the studio at one point. Mm. That was on a Thursday night. I probably could say this is fine. It's usually before we went on a night out. So there was a tiny little bit of free drinking beforehand. Not too much. Never completely drunk, and did a couple of shows there. That was really good fun. We had so much fun doing that. We used to do challenges. Mission Impossible, that's what we did in first year. Mission Impossible challenges. So we had, the way it worked, this is all coming back to me, I completely forgot all about this, Chris, that the other presenter would come up with a challenge for me to do during a song, and it was, we wouldn't do like a 2 minute song, but we'd do like a good 4 minute song. Bohemian Rhapsody was never allowed. I always wanted Bohemian Rhapsody to do the challenge in, and it would have to be something I had to do in that period of time. One of them, it was stupid stuff like having to go to the subway and buy a sub or something like that and get it back, get it ordered and made before the song finishes, or go to where our studio was right opposite the bar in the student union. So go to the bar and get a drink, and that might sound easy, but it was on a Thursday night that was packed, so that is a bit hard. One of them I remember was, I think it was eating the world's hottest chili, and I had to eat the full chili in a song. I think we might have used a Red Hot Chili Peppers.
I think we might have done
a Red Hot Chili Peppers song for that one. And I remember I just couldn't talk for the rest of that. My mouth was on fire, so I just had to just sit there while everyone else was talking for the rest of the show. But no, I had great fun doing radio. It's one of my favourite mediums. I love TV. Obviously, that's what I do now. But at some point in my career, I would like to end up back in radio. Maybe that's still doing full journalism, but not playing the music and having maybe as much entertainment, but at some point I'd like to end up back in radio, maybe in 10, 15 years, maybe in 2 years, who knows, but at some point I want to end up back in a studio doing radio, because it's a great medium. You can listen to it anywhere, like we're doing now.
Absolutely. Well, I grew up with radio, and so particularly, you know, I was born in 73, so the 80s really were an age, I was completely in the days of Radio 1, I gravitated to Radio 2 in the 90s. But in the 90s, Radio 2 in those days, I think the first part, under Francis Lyne, who was the director, who was the channel director, would always play music from a different era. So I'd be I was actually on Cabin FM, which is the station in Herne Bay that I broadcast on, and I was playing a lot of music from the early 60s, and I was channeling my parents, who actually, as it turned out, were listening. But that's the sort of stuff that I grew up with. So Radio 1 in the 80s, so all the stuff I listen to now on Sounds of the 80s or Pick of the Pops is the stuff that I remember from the day. But then I got to know a bit more about my parents' generation, so I kind of didn't take in new music. So I can blame Radio 2 for that. So the indie music that actually you hear a lot of Radio 2 now, that you obviously played when you were on a student or hospital radio, isn't something that I'm so familiar with. But there is something about sitting in a studio on your own.
Yes.
And that's what I want to ask you, because Zoo Radio... Steve Wright had Zoo Radio in the 80s.
He was one of the first to bring it in, wasn't he?
Yeah. And then even Wogan in the 90s had a form of Zoo Radio, because he'd have the travel presenter and his producer, and they'd all be interacting. But... I'm guessing that when you did the hospital radio, that was more you on your own.
That was me completely
on
my own.
Did you find that they were two very different beasts in terms of broadcasting, to be on your own or to be as part of, as you mentioned, at one point you were one of six?
Yeah, no, exactly. The hospital radio, that was completely on my own. Usually I'd be the only person in the building. It was in like a little outbuilding on the side of a hospital. Very old building, it was very creepy. When you go in, all the lights are turned off. And usually no one had been in there for a few hours, because there was usually a gap between daytime programming and evening programme. Hospital radio, there's a hospital radio network where there are syndicated shows, so that's kind of what usually got played during tea time. So, you know, people who retired would do the shows in the day, and people who work would do the shows in the evening. So there was no one ever really there before me. So I'd go into this building, had to unlock it, always had to remember the passcode to get into the building, so it was all alarmed. That was always a bit scary, because I'm terrible at remembering code, so I had to always remember to not set all the alarms off and send Merseyside police around to answer them. I never did set it off, but after the pandemic, I did have a massive panic attack. You have three attempts, and I got it wrong twice, and I was like, oh my god, I'm not going to get it right, I'm going in. Anyway, going off on a tangent again, Chris, I'm very good at going off on tangents.
Well, the tangents are the best bits. It's the liminal spaces, because those are the bits that are the drivers in what's going on. But
it's scary.
But between being on your own and being one of, say, six, you quite liked the experience of being on your own?
It was different. It was good to have that experience to do it differently. I think I prefer doing radio when there's more than one person, because you can bounce off somebody. Also, I can look at... Like the other presenter go, just talk for a second while I just go refiddle around with something. That was always useful to be able to do that. I'd always be the person doing the mixing on the desk. So it's good to have that. It was good to bounce off it. It was always quite hard. It's more of a monologue, isn't it, when you're doing it on yourself. And I think you can, when you're presenting on your own, it's easier to talk directly to the listener, which is the key with radio. You're talking directly to the listener. You're talking to somebody in the car, talking to somebody at home cooking. And I think it's easier to remember that when you're doing it on your own. But when you're doing it in a Zoo format, it's different. You are still talking to the listener, but they're more part of a big conversation. It's they're listening into this conversation. It's probably a bit more like a podcast rather. When podcasts, I don't think you really ever talk to the listener. I don't think that's kind of necessarily the aim of it, what most podcasters would do. But when you're on your own doing a radio show, when it was just me doing that hospital radio, I was directly using the word you all the time. So I think that's kind of the main difference I found. And I definitely spoke in a different way when I was doing hospital radio. I definitely acted a different way. And I think it was probably a little bit more well-produced when I was doing hospital radio, when I was doing on my own, because during the links, I'd be just chatting to everyone, turn the mics down, the conversation would continue. And then, the song's got 5 seconds, so I turn the mics back up and keep talking. And quickly scrambled to go and find a bed to go and play underneath it. But hospital radio, when I was doing it on my own, I wasn't talking to anyone in the breaks. I'm maybe checking the messages, but I'd be going through, looking at the songs, lining things up. And it was a very, it was a very slick show, because I could spend that time during the links to do it. And I'd always arrive about an hour before the show, maybe a little bit earlier, to go and pre-run everything through. Now, student radio, I didn't really have that chance to do it, because where it worked, not when I was doing it during the pandemic, because I was doing it from home, but when you'd go into the studio, the person comes off air, they play their last song, you've got to rush in and go and start doing it. But then I did learn there was an aux cord So then I downloaded a radio player software to my laptop and then ran it completely off my laptop so I could prepare the whole show on my laptop before going into the studio. So Hospital Radio, you know, it was definitely the well-produced one, but I think the audience on the shoot, really, they just want to have a bit of fun. They liked it when it all went wrong.
Well, absolutely. Did you ever get feedback? I mean, you mentioned the messages.
Oh, yes. Studio radio, never.
Yeah, but do you have any recordings of what you did?
I've got recordings somewhere. Yeah. Yeah, I'll find a few later at some point, Chris. They'll be lying around somewhere. Studio radio, they're probably... I did take recordings somewhere. There was one... I did actually get... Don't worry about this. I did get suspended once from Hot Student Radio once because it was nothing I did on air, but I was the last person on the air, so it was my job to lock the studio up. I locked the studio up, but then I went back home to my parents' house for the weekend with the key to the studio, so no one could do the show. And I clocked this one station down on the train. I was like, oh my god, I've got the key, and I even got off the train. I had to book two separate trains to get, obviously, the train to get back to Liverpool and get back down, but he's still suspended. Oh. It's fine. It was only for two shows.
But it sounds like the scene in The Shawshank Redemption, where he locks himself into the studios and he's playing the record player.
Yeah.
And in the end, they have to get a crowbar and they have to smash the glass. Yeah. So it wasn't quite on that scale.
No, it wasn't quite on that scale. No.
No. But there is something, I think you're right about the intimacy of radio. Sarah Kennedy used to be on at 5 a.m. on Radio 2. And, you know, she always spoke about how there was one listener. I don't know if she ever imagined a particular gender, but she was talking to one person. But it meant that all the millions of people who were listening thought that it was them, and genuinely so. And it was a conversation. It was very conversational radio.
Yeah.
And what I remember as well is growing up, even when there were guests, and I think this was the inspiration for the podcast, because you made a good point about whether a podcast is aimed at one listener, or whether, you know, that's even possible when you're sitting, when you're having a dialogue with a guest, as we are now. But I always remember, and it was the incongruity of it, because it might be an afternoon, you know, that people might be commuting, people might be on the, you know, travelling through London, or they might be in their country houses, or they might be, as I was, a university student and you know, working on essays. And there'd be a special guest, and Gloria Hanford used to do that in the afternoons. And she'd have someone, often somebody famous, or it might be someone who might be talking about the Oscars, or it might be somebody from a Carry On film, or whatever it might be. But there was a conversation, and it felt that even though they might have been there to promote something, that the conversation kind of went... Well, let's put it this way. If it had been planned... It felt like this was a genuine conversation, and it couldn't have been that. You know, there's no way they could have said, right, talk about this for 20 seconds. Like, when I'm on Ken tonight, I genuinely don't know what you're going to ask me. I might, obviously, I knew you were asking about film. I was talking about Kevin Costner for something. You know, I had no idea that I was going to be talking about Dances with Wolves, but that was relevant in terms of a Western he's got coming up. So it was this sense of eavesdropping. And I think with the podcast, the nicest compliment actually somebody ever paid me when they said, it's like being on a bus and you hear two people at the seat in front of you chatting, and your stop is coming up and you have to get off, and you've got a busy, you know, you've got things you have to do, but you think, well, actually, I don't want the conversation to end, so you stay on for one more stop or maybe two, and you think, well, I'm going to walk back, but actually, I need to hear the end of this conversation. Yeah. And so, in a way, that for me is why radio. And, you know, in a way, the podcast is me trying to emulate that, but I suppose I am doing radio now, so in a way, I've got the best of both worlds. But that sense of intimacy, which TV can do, but never to the same degree, because with radio, as you rightly say, you can be on the move, you can be in bed, you can be in the car, you can have your eyes closed, you can be in a hospital, you know, you can be in all sorts of different environments, and it can really impact on you in a way that television can, but I think to a lesser extent.
No, definitely. I mean, we are seeing more and more podcasts now which are shoving cameras into the studio to try and capture. I have no idea what the analytics look like on what the video podcasts do. I mean, podcasts, everyone's doing a podcast nowadays, and I think they are very successful. Because it is that intimacy what people want. People like to have that conversation. You know what I mean? I mean, I think definitely, particularly since the pandemic, I think we probably talk to less people in person. I think we do less things socially than we would have maybe in 2019. And I guess during the pandemic, we all found podcasts to be our friends fan radio to be our friends as well. And I guess that's kind of stuck a little bit, and kind of the way as a society we all, we engage socially in it. I guess it's kind of all changed. And podcasts are kind of now become part of parcel of our life. I mean, most people do listen to a podcast, and if I know family members who never knew what a podcast was, and I've suggested podcasts for them to listen to, they will get addicted to it. So I think podcasts are, there's something for everyone, regardless of how old you are and who you are, I think it's that nature of eavesdropping into conversations, but which still has something which is interesting to them. They all have a little theme to them, just find what you want. They're all just eavesdropping into somebody's conversation.
But also, because although they're of the moment, I mean, the fact that we're talking now on the 20th of June, and when this goes out, it could, I can decide when to put it out.
Yeah.
But it's likely to be either just before or actually could it be just after the general election.
Yes.
So, of course, listening back, this everything that we're saying now will take on a whole new meaning or significance because, events will inevitably impact on what we're saying.
Yeah.
But actually, listening back, like I do with radio, listening back to the stuff from when I grew up, if I have tapes of stuff from the 80s or 90s, and often those presenters are no longer with us, and it's a very different type of radio, perhaps, but that also is the key. That's why I asked you whether you've got recordings of your shows, because it's a moment in time. And two things. One is that you might listen and think, God, I sound awful. I'm embarrassed because that sounds very cheesy. I get all of that. But there's also another point, which is at that moment, there was a younger version of yourself that you recognise, and there was something of that moment without an innocent period almost, maybe, without all the things that subsequently happening. And what you're doing is a precious sort of, that was before that happened. That was before the pandemic. A good example is 2019. I was going around the country with my devices here and recording people in their homes, their workplaces, going to pubs, restaurants, wherever it might be, for my podcast. So in 2019, I had loads that were done in different places around the UK. That was my holiday in a way. It was lovely meeting people, not so much getting a podcast and saying, wish you were here. It's doing an hour-long interview and then recording that, and then anybody can tune in and partake. But when we had the pandemic, I missed all of that, and also how precious it was that I'd had those moments. But then during the pandemic, I was able to do interviews online. So suddenly I was interviewing people in New Zealand, Australia, Canada, America, around the world, my dream guests, if you like, and I was actually doing it. But although it was wonderful because I was never going to get a chance to interview them again, or I may not, ever meet them in person, I still now, to actually be in the room with the person makes a big difference. I suppose the person listening, it's a nice compliment if somebody says, "Oh, I didn't know whether you were in the room or not." They don't obviously pick it up, but there is something about the liveness of it. In the same way, I don't know how you feel about doing live TV as well. Mm. Is that you have to be in the studio to do it? You know, it wouldn't work if you were to do it in a format that was pre-recorded. The links sometimes have to be if you're doing a report. Obviously, that's pre-recorded. Yeah. But is there something about live TV or radio that for you continues to have a buzz?
Definitely. I can give you an example, which happened about, what time is it now? About an hour ago. We sometimes, for various reasons, have to pre-record a bulletin. And we had to pre-record the bulletin tonight, but it took us about 5 attempts to get started. Just because you can't, when you pre-record something, there's something in your brain which just switches off a little bit. This wasn't just me, we had to record this 5 times. It was some stuff in the studio, in the gallery. For people who don't know what a gallery is, it's where you push the buttons and pull things for things to go on air and sound to come up. And for various reasons, I had to record it, I think, five or six times. I think when you do live TV, there's something in the back of your head that knows, hang on a minute, this is live, and you just got to get it right. And even if something goes wrong, you ignore it, you skirt around it. And most of the time, I think the audience will never know if things are going wrong. And going back to your point on, saying doing Zoom interviews during the pandemic, definitely, if 2019, if you watch TV news, they'd very rarely use, maybe apart from rolling news where they were very hungry for content, they'd very rarely use something remotely over Zoom or on Skype or use VMix here at KNTV. Now, that's a lot more common. You'll see it on, even sometimes the main TV news is an evening, or have somebody joining live from their bedroom, from their office, on Zoom. And I think we've come, as an audience, a lot more receptive to that, and that has definitely changed. Then we've got to be careful, because I think you've got to be, you're telling a story, you can't tell, definitely with a case study, you can't tell a case study story that well, in my opinion, over a Zoom interview, because you don't have that connection to that person you're talking to. I did a story with somebody who was a domestic abuse survivor, and I actually did two ones on the same day. I did one with somebody over Zoom, and I did the second one with somebody in person, and you could definitely connect a lot more to that person over in person around with the person over Zoom, because I was able to get cutaway shots, which on Zoom you just can't do. It's just you looking at a computer, that's all you can do. And I think as an audience member, it's easy to switch off. So I think there's a level of, it's great we have that technology now, we can do it, but we can't become too reliant. And I'm not going to name companies, but I know there are some media outlets out there which are now becoming a lot more reliant on well, let's say virtual interviewing, which I think you've got to be very careful with.
Yeah, and I think that the liveness of it is interesting, because for the radio, I was told, well, you know, you don't have to come into the studio because it's in Herne Bay. I don't live in Herne Bay. But they said, you know, you can pre-record if you want and upload your links. No, I the whole point is that it has to be live.
It's more fun.
And if it goes wrong, and it sometimes did, because I pressed the button. Yeah. And at one point, the news came on 3 minutes early. I don't know what happened, but something. And actually, I was mortified by that, because I thought, you know, yeah, those are the sort of things that are not allowed to happen. But at the end of the day, it is live, and people were texting me and saying, "Oh, I'm listening to the show." I learned that my parents were listening,
yeah,
and that was interesting, because my sister was visiting, because they don't have internet or anything. And so she played it to them, so I was able to include them in the program, and that could never have happened if it's pre-recorded.
Exactly.
What you said is interesting when you said that you did a live show this evening.
Yes.
On obviously talking about
Film. Yeah.
And that was all live, and I watched it back not just a few minutes ago before we started recording, and it looked great. Now, interesting that straight after doing live TV, you did a pre-recorded thing, and you had to do 5 attempts.
Yeah, very rarely.
What does that say?
Yeah. I mean, it shows we're becoming perfectionists. When we're off air, it does. And I know when I'm doing, lots of time we do live reports and about location, but sometimes we have to do it as live as well. Those on the industry, it's what it sounds like, a live, but which isn't live, you just pre-recorded a little bit earlier. Sometimes that's just because what's going on in the background isn't going to be happening at 5:30 when we're going on air, and the only way to tell that story is doing a live. So if we were to do it at 5:30, there'd just be nothing behind us. Well, the interesting thing behind us, that's why we sometimes have to do it as live. Sometimes for logistical reasons, you have to do it that way as well. And I could never do it. I could never do it as live. But when you do it live, you're like, you gotta do it. And you have you go full tunnel vision into doing that live, you're fully focused into doing it, and it just happens.
Yeah.
You make mistakes.
Well, I found that the other day, because I wanted to do some film reviews and I on the radio show, and I couldn't get the Cavern of Cinema link up on the screen in the studio, and I knew I had like 45 seconds before the song ended. I'd already said I would be doing the reviews afterwards, so there was no way I could do it any other time. So I used my computer, but I had some of my own reviews on different pages, and I thought, I'm not ready for this, because I know I've got one review on this page, the other review on the other, and I need another monitor in order to get the listings. But the time was running down, and I thought, well, I've just got to do it. The song ended, and I did it. And listening back, considering I was having to press buttons all the time, I thought, actually, if I pre-recorded it, I don't think it would have been better. I'm not saying, the whole point is that it's not that it was perfect, it's the fact that it was a live thing, and anybody who listened to that could tell that it was live, and I thought, I couldn't have planned that. Literally, I didn't know the next thing I was going to be saying, because I was trying to hope that whatever came up on the screen would allow me to either read it out or generate a conversation around that. And you know, if I'd been told in advance it's going to be up to the wire, I would have panicked a bit, because I was doing it live. I just thought, well, I have to do it, and I literally have to do it in the moment. And that's interesting, because like with the podcast, I edit, but at the same time, sometimes one has to know when to let go, perhaps, as well.
No, definitely, exactly. I mean, back timings. I guess you've been learning all about back timings on radio. That's, I think, is a lot easier now than it probably was back when it was all on cassette reels and tapes and whatnot. Now it's all digital, it's on your screen. I don't know if it's on your player system, but I know when I had it, there'd be a big red dot and it would be counting down how long you had. And in between links, you knew how long you had to have to speak for. Yeah. And if you're anything like me, I would speak for way too long in the early sections. And when you come to the end, the last couple of links, you have 20 seconds. Yeah. And that's what you're saying, when you know when you need to stop. You know, sometimes and this is doing radio has practiced me well for TV, is you have to learn to be concise in what you're saying, learn how to finish a sentence early when you need to, and how to actually tell what you're going to tell. As I was saying, I'd use all my time up in the first half of the show and lose it all for the second half of the show. In that second half, what I planned to say in 2 minutes, I was like, oh, now I've got to actually say that in 1 minute. So it teaches you to say things a little bit more concisely sometimes.
Although in my case, what I learned and what I was told is, well, yeah, you've just got to take some of the music out towards the end, because it's set as if there are no links, that imagine I didn't turn up, then the computer would just play the show with the music I put in, and if I'm doing the show and there's more time, or the computer thinks there's more time because it doesn't know that I plan to speak for 3 minutes or something like that, then it'll add a song in. So I did the show 1 week, and suddenly the jingles of another program came in because the computer was obviously resetting itself. And at one point it said, read the travel. There was no travel. I didn't, where do I get that from? The computer was giving me, it's AI, isn't it? This is the problem. AI was telling me what to do. This is my first show. I had no clue. And it wasn't even my job to do that on that show. But very interesting, the evolution, from the days of the pirate ships, I suppose, where literally the discs would be spinning off, while they were playing, into the North Sea, to now when it's all, you press the button and it's all a bit too digitally perfect.
Yeah, it is a little bit too digitally perfect. Yeah. I think once I did play something with a CD. I think I definitely did. There was a song which wasn't loaded into the playout software, and then it was on CD, and I think I did play it through CD, and I definitely remember on one of the indie shows I did, didn't really work, but it sounded awful because it wasn't the proper wire I was meant to use. But I did play something on a vinyl live on radio, and I had no way on my. You'll know this. You're meant to have like a queue where you can queue and you can turn. You press the queue button and you can listen to it on your headphones, and it won't go out on air. The setup I had for my studio radio at home when I was doing that, I hadn't managed to figure out a way to queue stuff, so I could never queue music really. I think I could cue microphones, but I can never cue music to play. So I couldn't pre-get the vinyl I wanted it to. So I was like, right, now we've got, I think it was an Arctic, I think Arctic Monkeys had just released an album live on the Royal Albert Hall during the pandemic. I was like, I'm going to play this. It's a brilliant new album they just released. I'm going to play this. This is I Bet You Look Good on the Dance Floor. And it came in with, I don't know what it was, I think, Do I Want to Know, or something like that. And I was like, oh, no, I've got it wrong. So I was just going through, trying to find it. And that's the pretty thing on radio, is when things go wrong. I love it when things go wrong.
Well, actually, in that first show, I wanted to play Cumberland Gap by Lonnie Donegan.
Right,
in the late
50s.
And it's a very fast, only about 1 minute, 50 seconds or something like that. It goes, Cumberland Gap, Cumberland, and it's very fast. Yeah. And I made this joke about if you're in the car, obviously don't speed. And I said, if you're feeling a bit tired, this will wake you up. And I was making some joke about, we've got the news coming up, so Cumberland Gap will fill the gap before the news.
Yeah.
And I pressed the button and nothing happened.
Yeah.
So I should have just waited and it would have started. But I pressed it again and then the song started. But the moment it started, so like a quarter of a second in, it then went to the news. And I was mortified. Looking back, I should have just enjoyed the fun of it. But at the time, I was thinking, the whole point is that I'd made this link, and it was all like done to perfection, so that as soon as the song finished, it was the top of the hour. And I think that at the end of the day, would I give that up, or give it in to do something pre-recorded that was a bit more pristine?
Yeah.
And the answer is no. Because like with live TV, if you're not happy with it, as long as they want you back, then you'll turn up next week and hopefully you'll be better. You'll learn from it.
And I think most people in the audience don't really know when something goes wrong. But I don't think they would really clock sometimes. I mean, I can think of a couple of examples, which I won't mention now, but I know a couple of examples where I've been on a programme where things have gone catastrophically wrong. And that happens at any news company, any broadcaster. Every journalist, TV journalist, have had a moment when something's gone catastrophically wrong. It's just the nature of live TV. Something sometimes will go wrong, and it's a variable you can't help, whether or not it's a power cut, a live signal will cut out. I did a live report once where I had a fully charged battery and it just decided to break halfway through and just decided to pack in live, and it just, everyone across Kent just sort of saw me talking about how a youth centre was going to close, and it said no battery on the screen until they cut away to the studio. So some things go wrong, and it's a bit of fun, and I think the audience loves it.
Yeah.
When if you go on Twitter, as soon as something goes wrong with BBC News, it's going everywhere. So
yeah. Well, there was the famous episode, actually. I'm looking forward to interviewing, hopefully, Cameron at some point.
Yeah. Come on. Oh, yeah.
The famous moment. When, was it a check-in or someone? He was doing some report. And then the person he was talking about,
it was a cannabis bomb.
Then the guy who was the subject of the conversation.
Well, it wasn't him. It was the next door neighbour. Right. It was the next door neighbour, yeah. Came running out with a plant pot in the background. Yeah. And that went viral.
Yeah.
And I think it went viral in America because of Cameron's name, Cameron Tucker. And for Modern Family, I believe, I have watched it, but I think there is a character in there called Cameron Tucker, one of the main characters. And I think the likes of Jimmy Kimmel found that absolutely hilarious. But Cameron Tucker, a small town British journalist, and the whole thing that went behind it just made a perfect story. And that went absolutely everywhere. Newsnight, Jimmy Kimmel. KMTV's got a package. Type Cameron Tucker cannabis farm, and I'm sure.
I've seen it. Yeah, it does come up.
And it does the rounds on TikTok every few months. So it just gets, you're scrolling through your for your feed or for your profile feed. I don't know what it's called. Your feed on TikTok, and it's just like, oh, it's Cameron again. It's going viral. It's 500,000 views.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, you'll have to do something really infamous in the next few minutes if we're going to get that number on this podcast.
Exactly.
Because that's the goal. I mean, you wouldn't, what you'd give for that public, I'm sure Cameron is not disappointed.
Yeah.
It may be a bit embarrassing and awkward at the time, but you know, you priceless to get that kind of attention.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I had one moment which has been picked up by one tabloid, that I was doing a report earlier this year, maybe at the end of last year, and it was a really windy day. And a lot of the time, the stuff we do is self-shot, particularly my reports. But this live, I was doing self-shot. I was bouncing from another story. I was nearby, happened to have a camera which I could connect to the live signal on the top of a bridge. Windy day, halfway through the live. Camera starts to fall down. I grab it, so I go, great. It was a great shot of me looking absolutely terrified, grabbing the camera before it smashes onto the ground, because these cameras aren't cheap. And that was at the back of my mind. I was like, Jesus Christ, this is not going to be cheap if I did. It just smashes into the ground. And I carry on doing the live report. I think I was even clever. And it was to do with Operation Brock. It had just been brought in as an emergency. It was lots of traffic on the road, and I think I can't remember. I think I said there's delays at the port. Obviously, it's not going to be helped by the windy weather. I just saw by the camera falling. Thought nothing of it for a couple of months, and one of my colleagues, Bartholomew, was just searching through my name to see what stories other LD, local democracy reporting service partners had picked up. And he just came across The Sun had done an article on this done a full article. Didn't reach out for me for a quote. I would have happily given them a quote because it's quite funny.
I think I've had that before sometimes with the tabloids that they've sometimes asked if they could get a quote from me and actually they're just trying to get me to say something that they know will look good in the story.
Exactly.
So what they try and get you to say something, and I'm terrible at that because I would try and answer the question and go around the houses, and all they want is for me to say something that they want to say so they can put those words and describe them to me.
Earlier, I asked the same question three or four times. We all do it, don't we? Yeah.
Okay, well, as we start to wrap up, because I'm interested, obviously, in what the future holds as well, because you mentioned a bit earlier on that you'd like your own radio show but I mean, did you know when you were younger? I mean, obviously, you're compared to me, you're very young, as it is. But, you know, could you imagine a decade or so ago that you'd be doing this? Did you always know that you needed to disseminate yourself on radio, to broadcast, on TV, to broadcast? You mentioned that you didn't plan to go into journalism, but you were doing student radio and hospital radio when you were a student.
Yeah.
So do you think your younger self would be surprised at what you're doing now?
I think my younger self, I think if you go back 10 years... I'll actually be quite pleased that I'm here where I am now, because I think where I was 10 years ago, I was doing nothing really out in the open broadcasting, but definitely maybe even 15 years ago, just since now, I'm trying to think, I'm 25 now, so I think it was like year 7 or 8 at university, me and one of my friends were doing a radio show from my back garden shed, which didn't go anywhere, we just did it, because we could have broadcast it, but we'd had to play royalty-free music. We thought, oh, that's not fun. We'll just broadcast it and play real music. We did that for a bit of fun. So I kind of always had a bit of a oomph to do broadcasting. Whether or not I knew it was going to be journalism, I think the idea of journalism slowly started to trickle in, probably over the past 10 years. I did some charity work with a charity who does different sort of, was a bit of a pressure group, but not an apolitical, you know, I mean, it wasn't like centred at one party, stuff that like knife crime, domestic abuse, it was just loads of stuff, but rated on young people. And there I'd go to party conferences. I've been to the Labour Party conference twice. I think the first one I did was 2015. Been to the Conservative Party conference. So at the age of 15, 16, I think I'd interviewed James Cleverly, Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonald, at the age of 15. I didn't really think much of it, really. But looking back at it, it's quite a bit for a 15-year-old to do. And I know there's a picture of me with a holding a camera being interviewed by BBC's Adam Fleming, who does a very big podcast nowadays, Newscast. This was 2015, so this was before I think he even started doing any of that podcasting. It's a funny world. That I've gone from not knowing anything about the industry to always going to doing what he is doing now, not on as big a scale as he does, but it's, yeah, I think I'd be, going back to what I was saying at the start, I think I'd be pleased where I was going, but at that time, I probably didn't think I'd be going to where I'm going to be going, where I was now. So I think I'd definitely be pleased and happy.
Absolutely. And also there is something about second chances. I know that one of the films that you picked on the film show was Back to the Future.
Yes,
it
was.
I always think of the second film in that trilogy with the, because you've got is it called the deviant timeline or the alternate timeline?
Yes.
And I think a lot of people, and people I know, and I suppose myself have been living in this, would feel that you really relate to that, because sometimes it's about getting that back. Because for me, the idea of being a person who'd be on the radio potentially like counting down the charts or something, which is, I grew up, you know, Sunday evening at 5 o'clock, the charts would come out, you'd be writing them down. We didn't have, but we had teletext in those days, but because that was finite, it would disappear and then the next story would come in. So, you know, writing something down that when it was broadcast on the radio, not knowing that all these decades later, of course, we'd have all these sort of storage facilities through MP3 and through podcasting and through digital radio, etc. So capturing that moment in time seemed to really matter, and preserving it. And then looking back on this all these decades on...
Social history.
It absolutely is. So for me, in those days, the thought, it was inconceivable that I could ever be that person in the studio doing it, because it was such a big deal. And I was a young person and these people were so obviously experienced. But I followed a different path, but now I seem to be going back to the thing that I always knew I wanted to do. And not everybody gets that chance, but you don't get that chance three times over. So it's almost like this is the moment. And for you, do you kind of feel that you can relate to that? That sort of sense of, I mean, you're already in the profession, but you kind of feel, okay, there are certain things that you want to do, and you must feel fairly secure and confident that the opportunity will come, because you're already, like, at the age of 15 interviewing Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah.
You know, you're already on that trajectory in a way that I wasn't.
Yeah, you never know. And I think I was doing lots of different things at that time, and things slowed. I mean, if you look back at it and look at the different steps, you look at the CV, you can see that's definitely the path I was going on. But I think at that time, when you're in the thick of GCSEs, going into A-levels, then you go to university, sometimes, you know, there's lots of different angles. You start to go down a different tangent, but that finishes. But if you look at the one thing that stays consistently is that element of broadcasting. I think the journalism swings in and out a little bit, but it's always been there, I think, probably for the past 10 years. Maybe if you go further, if you go back to the whole teletext thing I said at the start, but reading off a news article from the TV's hardly.
No, but do you have family members who were doing anything like this?
No. Same first, here. My granddad was a councillor. He still is a parish councillor. So I've always had a little bit of politics in my family. And I guess that works well for my new role, covering local councils. And I've had a little bit, I kind of understand a little bit through him, knowing stuff. So I guess that's always been there. I think everything does intertwine at some point. But no, I mean, I'm happy where I am. I mean, my dream job was to be a pilot. That was my dream job. But I never followed a path to go that way. A, it's incredibly expensive. B, you have to be good at maths. And I'm not good at maths, so that's kind of brushed aside. But maybe in 15, 20 years' time, maybe I might suddenly become good at maths and go back into become a pilot one day. Get a program pilot's license. I'd love to do that one day. But I'm doing, sorry, but I had always had it as a dream. So there you go.
Well, yeah. I've got one more question, okay. Which is, would you consider yourself, Gabriel, to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
That's a good question. After today, recording this, definitely looking back, because the stuff we talked about today, which I completely forgot about, it's brought up things from the past which I completely forgot about. I think mostly looking to the future. But I'm going to be looking back into the past a little bit more after today.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, what a wonderful chat. I think we covered...
Yeah, we covered everything.
Everything. There we are.
Very briefly covered Cardiff. We never went into it that much.
Ah, well...
There you go. For another day.
Gabriel, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you so much, Chris.